What is up, Super 90s brothers and sisters? This is Brennan, one half of your favorite 90s duo, and I've got some seriously exciting news to share. Adam and I are packing our fanny packs and heading straight to Lilac City Comic Con, where we will again be podcasting live on June 2nd. That's right, we're diving headfirst into a sea of nostalgia surrounded by over 250 exhibitors, artists, and professional guests. It's like stepping into a time machine and landing smack dab in the middle of your favorite decade. But hold on to your pogs. On this live version of the show, we'll be covering the 1989 classic, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. But wait, it gets even better. Joining us on the podcast will be none other than Amy O'Neill herself, the one and only Amy Zielinski from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. So get ready, dust off your Walkmans, and break out those slap bracelets and get your tickets to Lilac City Comic Con in good old Spokane, Washington. Visit www.lilaccitycon.com to get your tickets today. Now, enjoy Super 90s Brothers.
It's the Super 90s Brothers!
Thank you, Dave Brubeck Quartet, and hello and welcome to the Super 90s Brothers.
Ow!
Where we do hazy memory riffs on the most colorblind decade ever. I'm your host, Brennan Pointer. Along with me is my co-host, Adam J. Pitzler. And today we're talking about Pleasantville.
Ow!
Welcome back. I'm not going to say it's been a while, but it's been a while. What's that?
How have you been?
I've been great. I've been really good. It's been busy here at Spocast. Been busy in everyday life. Just got back from spring break with the kids. You went to spring break or spring training down in Peoria, Arizona. How was that?
Oh, it was great. When you're a young man, you kind of have like more fun trips maybe that you have to choose. But as you get older and you want things at like a certain speed, like spring training started to sound really appealing. Mm. And I went down there with my wife and one of my friends, and it was so fun, dude. We like every day we got this B&B. We'd get up, we'd like pack a bunch of good shit in our like backpacks. We'd go to the Mariner game. We'd hang out in like the outfield and have like a picnic on like a blanket in the outfield with like, you know, shit we snuck in and stuff like that. And then the game's over. We have a nice dinner somewhere. We go out drinking and partying in beautiful Arizona, like warm evenings. Hmm. It was great. It was an amazing trip. I was like, me and my friend Tony, we're talking about, we got to do this every year. Like, we got to invite Mariner friends. We got to make this a thing. Like, we do a fantasy football trip every year. We need to do like a spring training trip every year. This is great.
I've never been. I really want to go. I've heard nothing but great things. Did you get any home runs or any, like, did you get any interaction with the players?
Not really, but only because I was there with my wife too. Mm. And like, I was kind of trying to minimize the amount of baseball she had to endure because baseball's just not her thing. So I didn't like show up early and stay late and try and get autographs and all that. I like just attended the games and left to kind of minimize that. But if I was good to go with buddies, I would totally do that. A couple home runs came really close to me in the outfield, like super close. And there's not like a ton of people. So every time one gets hit, you kind of think, maybe I can catch this, but I didn't.
Well, it's nice to be back talking about all things 90s and, well, not all things, but movies and TV shows and video games.
And if you guys like talking about movies, TVs, and video games, all you got to do is give us those awesome 5-star reviews on Apple iTunes Music, on all the podcast platforms that you follow us. It really helps us reach out to a bigger audience. Leave a nice little review. Talk about Brennan's growing beard. He's looking more and more like a man from Game of Thrones. You can reach out to the show, Super90sBrothers@gmail.com, all spelled out, @Super90sBrothers. Brennan is @SpocastPods, and we're just excited to do another fun show for you today. And I want to set the scene on the show first, like I always do. So Close your eyes, even if you're driving on the freeway. Close your eyes, Brennan. It's October 1998. Picture yourself. It's the fall. Ginger Spice has just broken off the group, devastating thousands of 10-year-old girls. You've just finished watching another hilarious episode of Veronica's Closet when the radio starts playing.
China, the Chinese chicken. You have a drumstick and your brain stops ticking. Watching X-Files with no lights on, with all our maisons. I hope the Smoky Man's in this one. Like Harrison Ford, I'm getting frantic. Like Sting, I'm tantric. Like Snickers, guaranteed to satisfy. Like Kurosawa, I make mad films. K, I don't make films, but if I did, they'd have a samurai. Gonna get a set of better clubs, gonna find the kind with tiny nubs, just so my irons aren't always flying off the backswing. Gonna get into my Sailor Moon, cause the cartoonist got the boom anime babes that make me think the wrong thing. How can I help it if I think you're funny when you're mad? Trying hard not to smile, though I feel bad. I'm the kind of guy who laughs at a funeral. Can't understand what I mean, you soon will. I have a tendency to wear my mind on my sleeve. I have a history of losing my shirt. It's been 1 week since you looked at me. Dropped your arms to the sides and said I'm sorry. 5 days since I laughed at you and said you just...
That was a number two song in the U.S. at the time. 1 week by Bare Naked Ladies.
This is totally the kind of music I envision, like, Brennan dancing alone to in his room in high school. Am I close?
No, I definitely had this album.
I'm not just close, I'm spot on.
You're spot on. No, I mean, I don't, how was I dancing to this? I mean, I was just probably listening to it and, like, playing video games. That was, like, my big thing. I listened to music and play video games, and definitely listened to a lot of Bare Naked Ladies. This brought back a lot of memories, because I was, like, I remember really just loving this song, because it was kind of my vibe. It was, like, pop music, but also had a little bit of, like, rap in it, like, white guy rap.
Yeah, the whole thing is white guy rap. I mean, it's pretty much like ADHD rap. He's talking about Chinese food, then he's talking about flavors of this and shit he did at this corner of that. Like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, I don't know where he's going with any of it.
Yeah, I don't. There might be some reasoning to it when he, like, wrote it. My biggest problem is at the end of it, it's kind of, like, very mumbly. Like, you can't really understand what he's saying. And I dislike that today, but back in the 1998. Brennan wasn't thinking about that. He just thought he enjoyed the song. But
this song is incredibly popular amongst, like, young white men.
Yes. Yeah. That's fair.
Can't figure out why.
What did you think of the video?
It was lame. I mean, the video's all over the place, just like the lyrics. Like, I can't tell what's going on. You know, it's... What do you think?
This is, like, every 90s video, I'm realizing. Like, there's no plot to it. They just, like, basically take their band and put them in, like, scenes. Like, the beginning is, like, they're in, like, some court. Like, not court. Like, like a castle court, or, like, where a king would sit. Like, it's all kind of really elevated and really weird. Then they're in Dukes of Hazzard, and then they have, like, an Evel Knievel scene where, like, some woman's doing a stunt over, like, a ravine. I don't know. It makes zero sense. They're just playing music and having basically fun. They're like, let's spend some money and have fun in a music video, and who cares about the story?
Brennan, you've been diagnosed with ADHD not that long ago.
Right.
Is there any part of this song that makes sense to you as a person who suffers from ADHD? Because I legit think that's what's going on. Like, this dude's brain is just going all over the place.
Yeah, that's funny. That's exactly how my brain works. Like, I will be, like, thinking about one thing at one time, like, go to the next thing, and, like, all the thoughts come into my head at once. And if I'm not on my Adderall, I will be super, like, I will not be able to get tasks done. So, yeah, it is very ADHD, like, centric, I guess.
Is the rapper guy just making shit up that rhymes? Like, yeah. You know, like, I think that's been a problem of mine with rap in general, or with a lot of songs in general. Like, if the lyrics don't make sense and they're just serving to rhyme, I sort of, like, as a writer, I get sort of judgy. Like, you're just making shit up at that point.
I don't know. I'm reading this first verse. You'll think you're looking at Aquaman. I summon fish to the dish, although I like the Chalet Swiss. Like, I like sushi because it never touched a frying pan. It kind of has, like, a story there if you read it, because it's talking about Aquaman, it's talking about fish, eating fish, and then, like, hot like wasabi when I bust rhymes, like sushi, wasabi. It's all kind of, it does kind of connect in a verse, but you wouldn't know that if you didn't read the lyrics. So
a bunch of shit that doesn't make sense, though, too. That's gonna make gonna make a break and take a fake. I'd like a stinking, aching shake. I like vanilla. It's the finest flavor. It's got to see this. Like, who's talking about vanilla? What are we talking about flavors? Where did that come from?
So true. I don't know. I don't know. It does not. You know, it doesn't really make sense. The song is. I should have looked at what the song's about, but it's basically
There's like a little bit of a story of like you act like you're mad at me, but we'll get over it. Like it's sort of like a couple's going through like a little tiff, but they know they're gonna get over it, right?
Right.
Like that... but most of the lyrics have nothing to do with that theme. You know?
Totally.
All right. Well, what do you think of the band's name then?
I think it was catchy back in the day because like you're bare naked ladies.
But you're a bunch of clothed dudes.
that's true. It's very much a bait and switch.
Yeah, if you were a 12-year-old boy and you clicked on that video, you're probably really disappointed.
I mean, that's what it was. And like they had gotten famous. I remember I didn't really know who Bare Naked Ladies was until maybe this song or another song came out. But they had that one song, like 1 million or If I Had $1 Million.
That was them, the slow one?
Yeah. Oh. And that's like how they got famous. Like that came out early and then...
What, yeah, do you hear at weddings?
If I had... I don't even know how the song really goes, but yeah.
$1 million. And it's like, it's sort of like a song about like money doesn't matter.
Right.
And like, play it at their weddings. They like dance to it.
Oh, yeah. I've never read the lyrics of that one. I don't really. I just remember a lot of my friends really liked that song. So,
okay. So this was definitely your kind of music. You were a bare naked lady.
Did you have
posters of bare naked ladies on your wall, Brennan?
No. What did I have posters of on my wall? Probably had a.
That's a great question, actually. What posters did you have on your wall in high school?
I think I might have had like a Prefontaine. He was a runner
that
died tragically. I think I had a Rocky poster. Like they were very like running centric.
Oh, okay.
Like Rocky IV.
Okay. I love Rocky IV. That was my favorite.
And I definitely had a girl poster. I need to ask my dad. I feel like I had a girl poster just because I feel like my dad expected me to have one because he probably had like a Farrah Fawcett on his wall. And like my dad's like, oh, you need to have a girl on your wall.
I had a Pam Anderson pre all of her surgery on my ceiling. Like it was like a really early, like late 80s, early 90s Pam Anderson, like pinup, full body, like on my ceiling above my bed. That was awesome.
Oh, wow. You see with the bed every night looking at that.
Yeah. I mean, when you turn the lights off, you can't really see it. I had a Cruel Intentions poster.
Oh, wow.
Well, and like Sarah Michelle Gellar's like cleavage was out, which is one of the reasons why I liked it.
Mm. Well.
So anyway, back to Pleasantville. Speaking of the finest of the flavors, today we're talking about the 1998 gem Pleasantville. Brennan, how old were you when you first saw this movie? Tell me about your impressions.
Well, I will say this is a movie I did not see in a theater. It was
that's so rare for you. You went and saw everything in the theater.
At least I don't think I saw. This is 1998, so like, always forget how old I was in 98. 14 or yeah, I was 14 years old. I might have seen it in the theater because like I would have been a freshman. It would have been right around that time because like I was The Matrix was out or coming out, and it was definitely like something. But I don't remember. I don't have a distinct memory. What my memories of this movie were seeing the trailer and being like, "This movie's in black and white." Oh no! Wait a minute. Now it's in color. And it had Reese Witherspoon and Tobey Maguire, Reese Witherspoon was somewhat famous, and Tobey Maguire was like up and coming. Like I don't really remember too much about like how I felt about it, except that it was in black and white. I really loved Nick at Night at the time, so I might have been drawn to it to see it just because I loved watching old 50s sitcoms, and like I loved I Love Lucy and the Dick Van Dyke Show. Like no like young teen should be watching that kind of stuff, but it was always on late at night. And so
hey, Lucy's a great comedian. She's funny to anyone everywhere. I would argue Dick Van Dyke, you take it or leave it, but
right.
Lucy is amazing.
Yes. So yeah, I definitely was like interested in seeing it, and I watched it probably when it came out and we watched it on VHS, and I definitely learned a lot about sexuality and what that meant watching this movie. So,
really? Yeah. My favorite part of the show.
Brennan's bad synopsis. Ow.
I actually have like anxiety to do this today.
Great.
So really everyone's going to have to bear with me today because I wanted to rewatch this because I wanted to familiarize myself with the movie and figure out what the plot is. And oh boy, there's a lot happening in this movie. The movie starts off with basically, man, this is already going really bad.
In color.
Help me out one second.
Oh man.
The movie starts off with like
opening credits.
Opening credits of the TV show Pleasantville, correct? Or whatever the show is called, right?
Something like that. Yeah, like Tobey Maguire is like watching the show.
Tobey Maguire is watching the show. And then basically we find out that Tobey Maguire, his character, David, is a super fan of this TV show. So Pleasantville is a TV show that's like on reruns. And Tobey Maguire is a super fan. And he has a twin sister, Reese Witherspoon. Her name is
Jennifer.
And basically they are like opposite twins. Like, she's popular and she is really into guys and all the things, and Tobey Maguire's character is just a big nerd, and he really
not a guys at all.
Yeah, it's actually kind of weird, like him talking about how much he knows about Pleasantville and the sitcom is weird. And basically what happens is on a Friday night, there's going to be a marathon of Pleasantville, and Tobey Maguire plans to watch it. And then, because the next day, there's going to be a quiz, or he can, like, basically try to win $1,000 with his knowledge of Pleasantville. Well, at the same time, his sister's having a guy that she really likes over, and they kind of fight over who gets to watch the TV that night. Because there's only one TV in their fucking house, apparently, that has cable.
Really? What a bunch of fucking losers.
What a bunch of losers. And so they end up fighting over the controller, and it breaks. And now there's a line in the movie. This is the one thing that stuck with me. It was like the controller breaks, and they're like, well, what do we do now? And they're like, well, can't you just turn the TV on from the TV? And he's like, no, this is a new TV. You have to have the remote. And then at that same time, a TV repairman knocks on the door and says, hey, I can help fix your remote. And that is played by
Don Knotts,
and who is a famous, you know, very, very famous, like 50s sitcom actor from Andy Griffith. And he finds out that Tobey Maguire loves Pleasantville so much, and he gives him a magical remote that basically transports him and his sister to Pleasantville. Now they've taken over the roles of the two main brother and sister in the show, and now they're in this Pleasantville world. Like, and that's when the movie starts.
Right.
Oh my God. This is where
12 minutes into the synopsis, we're 4 minutes into the movie.
My God. Yeah, no kidding. Well, that's really like, that's the plot. Like, that's like the how they get there. Like, and so they get there, and basically, they find out that like everyone's very vanilla, boring. Everything's perfect in this world. They all go to their places at the right time. They make all their basketball shots. They like everything's very, very, for lack of a better term, like hunky dory, perfect. Like, I won't even say perfect. It's just like it's idealistic, I guess. But we put Toby and Reese Witherspoon in this, and she's like
a hoe.
I wouldn't call her. She's a woman of the 21st century, I would say. She like is very like sex positive. She like, and she wants to like help open the mind of these people, because the one thing Tobey Maguire and Reese Witherspoon's characters learn is that like these people are repressed. They don't know anything about sex. They don't know anything about doing things for themselves or being happy. They just do what they're told and go from A to B and never ask any questions about anything. And And that's why this plot is hard to explain, because like now you introduce all this cast of characters. Like it has a humongous cast of characters from Jeff Daniels, William H. Macy, Joan Allen, Paul Walker, rest in peace. And there's a bunch of other actors, but basically it's Toby and basically Reese Witherspoon, her character wants to basically awaken all these people and help them learn about that. And like Toby's really like, no, we can't let them learn about this because it's going to ruin their world, their perfect idealistic world. And Reese Witherspoon's like, no, we got to change that. And as Tobey Maguire's character, like, very much wants to keep everything in line, like I said, but then he realizes, like, no, like, we need to also help these people, because he's also getting, he has like a, starts getting a side piece.
Right. We need to help these people become sexually liberated now that I'm dating the hot blonde cheerleader.
Right. Who's she played by? I love her.
I always forget her name.
But I think it's Marley I don't have the
she was in Sin City.
Yeah, she's great. But basically what happens is you start getting people that like are like the mom and dad, William H. Macy and Joan Allen, they are the like kind of, they play on both sides. Like Joan Allen had this like love with like kind of a love affair with
Jeff Daniels
character, and I forget why, what happened there. Like it was that like a pre, like was there one little story arc to that happened pre that like Tobey Maguire lays out?
But I want to plug our Speed podcast where Brendan kept referring to Jeff Daniels as Jeff Daniels. So Jeff, go back.
Jeff Daniels.
Yeah, Jeff Daniels. Check out our Speed podcast in our library if you like making, if you want to hear me really make fun of a movie.
But long story short, basically, and this is like, where I kind of get lost, is it doesn't really make much sense, is like now the build up to this is like there's a court battle. There's like the white men, like the people who don't want to change there. And you would be describe them as the racist people.
Well, they're the dads that don't want change. They want everything to stay the same way.
Right. And then you have all the like liberated people, and some of them are adults like Joan Allen and Jeff Daniels. And they want to change because like they see like there's a world better of being like more open to different ideas. And
they all got laid.
And that was the biggest thing about this, is like the change of people. Like, so what happens to people in this world is the reason why they're in black and white is because they have no personality. They aren't liberated. And it's all based around basically sex and like exploring yourself. Right.
Well, it's not quite as simple as sex. It's about repression, really, is what the director said. The director said personal repression gives rise to greater political repression. So if everyone's repressing their own feelings, then it becomes a political issue where where the idea is that everyone should repress these feelings. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because people are doing it themselves and they want to fit in.
Yeah.
And then stop doing it and you realize that they can fit into.
Right.
That's kind of the point of the movie. It's not exactly as neat and tidy as maybe like a 2024, you know, social justice warrior might want to make it. There's a little bit more going on. And it's not really about color. It's not really about sex. It's about personal growth. Mm. And it's about outgrowing establishments. Like if there's an establishment that says, this is how we're supposed to be, this is the way we're supposed to act, it's okay to outgrow it.
Right. So the big like climax, or the Indian, like they're in the courtroom and then they, I don't remember what the judgment was, but basically they decide to liberate themselves and like now they are all living amongst each other, but then they now can travel to the real world, and which is I don't understand. Like Reese Witherspoon decides to stay in Pleasantville, and Tobey Maguire decides to go back to the real world with his girlfriend. And
TV repairman like fixes the remote at some point, and like he allows the kids to come back if they want. And for some reason, Reese doesn't come back. She wants to. Doesn't she say she wants to stay and like learn and travel and stuff? Like,
I don't.
But Pleasantville keeps getting populated with things by the real world via Tobey Maguire, like, because he knows the story of Huck Finn, like Huck Finn's now in the library, like shit like that. So now that, like, he knows there's more world, there's something outside of Pleasantville, which is a famous quote from the movie, I believe the idea is that now Pleasantville is populated with things outside of Pleasantville and you can go experience them.
Ah, that makes sense. I mean, I was watching it the other night and I was like kind of blown away by it because I was just like, this is actually very like topical in today's world. And I was like, I think it might have, like, it kind of might have fell on deaf ears back then because it was, this is pre 9/11. This is pre like wokeness. It's pre a lot of things.
Yeah.
And they were trying to tell something that like wasn't really as relevant back then as it is like today, I feel like.
Yeah, and I think the message is purer in Pleasantville than the message is today. The message isn't about race or sex or anything specifically. It's about being who you want to be.
Mm. Yeah.
To me, that's a much cleaner, purer, non-politicized message, you know?
Totally. And that was, yeah, I will say that's one thing about this is that it wasn't very, it's not very politicized at all. It's very much like black and white.
Which, good one.
Bad Brennan's bad synopsis is because the plot of this movie is very, I think it's very complicated and there's a lot going on in it. And there might be a little bit too much going on in it.
You didn't really talk about what happens either. Like kind of like what, like, you know, they all, like the community, they all start to experience these changes together and their minds grow and their worlds grow and their perceptions grow, in which case their opinions about their behaviors grow. And you get to see like a culture go from very basic, very buttoned up to sort of more exploratory and free and open. Yeah. I can't remember who said it, but somebody was on like Rogan like a few months ago, and they made this great point about San Francisco. And for those that don't know, I live near San Francisco, and there's a lot of criticism about like San Francisco City, Portland, LA for like the homelessness and things like that. And this guy that was on Rogan made this great point. He said, you need to understand that there are parts of the world that are just more extreme, and good things and bad things come from these extremes. And he mentioned rock and roll music came straight out of Haight-Ashbury. And he mentioned like the Silicon Tech Valley bubble and all these like sort of entrepreneurial thinkers and people thinking outside of the box. And like he was saying that like this is sort of the other side of the coin of this, of sort of the seedy drug use and multiple partners and some of the sort of the negatives that you get from sort of these exploratory lifestyles. But he says you need to learn as a society to accept both. You need to realize that without some of these problems, you don't get fucking Jimi Hendrix. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I never really thought about it quite like that.
That's a great point. Yeah, like I think it is why I am very open to like other people's ideas, is because like I might not choose to, you know, be, you know, like some, like I was going to say like people that are polyamorous, people who have multiple partners. Like I would never choose to be polyamorous, but I also would never choose to like not let them live their life. And I feel like,
what if your wife chose to be polyamorous?
You know, it'd be a conversation we'd have to have.
It'd be a long conversation.
Any other story beats that I really missed? Like,
No, I just wanted to. No, you're pretty good. We should get into it.
Yeah.
So the main characters. First of all, the movie was kind of a bomb. To date, it's made just less than $50 million, but it had a $60 million budget. And that's to date. So this is 26 years of revenues now. So this movie lost money. I remember thinking that it was marketed strangely. Like I couldn't really tell what was going on, what the theme was. I couldn't. The previews to me didn't sell the grandness of the movie at all. And I that could just be I was too young. Or it could be what Brennan said earlier, where we weren't kind of ready for some of these messages, or they just weren't really on our minds to receive them right. Right?
Yeah, totally.
So anyway, so the movie didn't make money. It lost money. But most people really like this movie. In fact, let me just – the Rotten Tomatoes score real quick is 86% based on 97 reviews. That's very good.
Yeah.
So the main character, Tobey Maguire, You know, Brennan said he was getting kind of recognizable. You know, he hadn't really done a lot where he was important in the movie at all. Like, he had been in the movie Ice Storm, which maybe you saw, maybe, but a lot of people didn't see that. It was kind of like an adult drama.
Mm-hmm.
I would say he wasn't famous till Pleasantville, because after Pleasantville, then came out Cider House Rules and Spider-Man, like, in the next, like, year and a half.
Yeah.
So, like, Pleasantville was sort of like his debutante ball, if you will, from my perspective.
That's true. I feel like it must have been, yeah, you're right. When I'm looking at this, his biography, or not filmography, it really is Pleasantville, and then he was in Wonder Boys, Spider-Man, Seabiscuit. Like, there was a time where, like, Tobey Maguire was, like, he was kind of, like, the one of the biggest actors in Hollywood at the time.
Yeah, his very first IMDb credit is in the movie The Wizard, which Brennan and I have reviewed. It was our first episode. I don't know. Is that still up there? Did we delete it because of shitty audio?
I think we deleted it.
Redo it. Anyway, the movie The Wizard is a really fun, and he plays like Lucas's goon or something. Like,
yeah.
Like the dorky kid with the power glove. He was like one of his little cronies. Funny. My wife like famously says that Tobey Maguire is her ugly crush. Like if she was going to be with somebody ugly, it would be with Tobey Maguire, at least when she was like 20.
That's funny. I don't think he's that ugly.
Well, but compared to me, really.
It's fair.
The high bar. So anyway, Tobey Maguire's character is kind of unique, because he's typically your main character is the protagonist, but I don't personally see him as a protagonist, and I'm going to talk about that with you more later, but he's more like the narrator of the movie.
Mm.
He, like, knows what's going on, and he tells everybody what's going on the whole time. Like, he's constantly answering the movie's questions that every other character is asking the whole time.
Yeah, he's, the conscious of the movie. I mean, I guess it's the narrator, technically. And so he, yeah, because I think he sees it both ways. And, yeah, we're going to play a drop from you where Tobey Maguire is explaining something about the world that he comes from.
There are some places that the road doesn't go in a circle. There are some places where the road keeps going.
Keeps going?
Yeah, yeah, it just keeps going. It all keeps going, roads and rivers and
like the mighty Mississippi.
What?
So yeah, one thing we didn't really talk about is that in this movie there's one like central place that all the high schoolers, like the adolescents, like hang out, and that's like what do you call those places, like a restaurant, but it's not a restaurant, it's like a
old like soda restaurant, like soda fountain, soda jerks, it's a sock hop.
They hang out with there, and like Jeff Daniels is like, he owns this restaurant, and they go eat burgers and milkshakes there. So all the high schoolers hang out, and so this is where they all kind of congregate to kind of learn about the outside world, because it's the only really safe space, because Jeff Daniels is like the only adult in the Pleasantville that will accept them, right?
He's not married like almost all the other guys there. Like, he doesn't have a family. He's
right.
Just like it works this place flipping burgers for the high schoolers.
Yeah. So that was this Tobey Maguire explaining like where he comes from, like the roads aren't circles, because in Pleasantville, like, you can't leave the town. Like, you have to stay in Pleasantville, and where he's from, you can go anywhere, right?
Yeah, and that's a good message of the movie, right? Especially like when you're young or stuck in life and you think there's no roads out. You know, you think that everything leads to the same thing. And that's sort of a depressive thought, you know, like no matter what I do, I'm going to end up at the same place.
Yeah.
And this is a much more modern, that's just not true. The world's just way too big and chaotic to feel that way.
Mm. Do you think Tobey Maguire in this movie, I feel like I hadn't, obviously this is our like kind of introduction to him, but watching it now, I'm just like, he's just playing the same character that he plays in most of his movies. Like, he's just playing like a ho-hum, like, same character he plays in Spider-Man. I don't know, something about Tobey Maguire is just like, he has really good roles sometimes, but like, most of the time he just plays kind of a boring, vanilla, white guy.
I don't, I've never really found him overly dynamic as an actor. I guess that's kind of what you're saying. You're saying he's kind of always the same.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of actors that are like that, that like you like their personality and you cast them routinely in movies and they have sort of similar personalities. I think a far extreme example of that is like Pauly Shore.
Mm.
But like, there's a lot of actors that do that, that they like, they have kind of a look or a thing that they, that people like them as, and they just do it again and again. And if you're getting it in like A-list movies in leading roles, you're doing it for millions of dollars. So you're going to keep doing it.
Totally.
But can you imagine like Tobey Maguire is like, I don't know, a Bond villain or like anything that's not so archetype of what you know of him? It just would seem weird, right?
Yeah, very weird.
I don't think it would work. And I think that's one of the reasons Maguire's career has pretty much tapered off. You know, you take Spider-Man out of Tobey Maguire's career and there's not a lot of meat there.
Well, that, and after Spider-Man, he kind of just disappeared for like a long time. So
you say disappear, I say he's not getting roles because of what you just said.
Yeah, no, totally.
Yeah. All right. So the next character we should talk about is Reese Witherspoon as Jennifer. You could argue she's the protagonist. And again, we're going to have this discussion. Now, she had been in the movies Freeway with Kiefer Sutherland, which is this really crazy, like, 1994 Red Riding Hood parable movie, which is pretty funny at times, but also very indie and weird at other times. She was in the movie Fear with Marky Mark, like, the year before. And after this, she did Cruel Intentions and Election. So this was right in her sweet spot, right as she was getting famous. Brennan called her sexually liberated, which is the 2024 way of saying ho. but in the movie, she learns that her brain matters too. But what she's really good at is she's really good at kind of like cutting through the bullshit and telling and kind of like giving you some of the female perspective of this repressed culture.
You don't understand. You're messing with their whole goddamn universe.
Maybe it needs to be messed with, David. Did that ever occur to you?
Hey, MS, how you doing?
Cool, PJ, how you doing?
Cool. What are you doing to these people? You can't do this to them.
If I don't do it, who will?
No, but they're happy like this.
No, David, nobody is happy in a poodle skirt and a sweater set.
I love Reese Witherspoon. She's great in this. What do you think of her character in this? Like, I feel like I had known about her, about Reese Witherspoon, before I saw this, like, a little bit, just because like I'd seen the movie Man in the Moon, which is her very first movie, and then I had seen Fear. I love Fear.
I like Fear too.
And
it's stupid, but I like it.
And I never saw Freeway until I met my wife Abby. Freeway is like one of her favorite movies, and like in Freeway, like it really like shows like she shows her range because she plays like a character that you would never have expected her to play at that time. Like she's like just a badass in that movie.
Like a white trash, like rebel, like fighter. It's like Freeway's a really fun, unique indie that I recommend.
Yeah.
And I'm glad Abby likes it. My sister was on Freeway when it came out, so I saw it like shortly after it came out. But her Reese's role in this movie is kind of what I said. I feel like she's there to give you some of the female perspective on kind of what repression can do. And she's sort of like overly liberated at the beginning of the movie. She's like, she's sort of lost her core values and she's only experimenting on the far, we'll call it the far left side of the spectrum, as opposed to the far right side, which we'll call Pleasantville. And she finds balance through Pleasantville. She realizes that you have to have the yin and the yang. You know, you can't just be sex, drugs, and rock and roll. There needs to be personal relationships and substance and learning and personal growth too. And so she's almost like if you had two people arguing, and you can politicize this argument. If you had two people arguing about what the best way to live is, you've got sort of examples on both sides of why both extremes aren't correct, which is something you'd never hear either side say anymore. You know what I mean? And that's again why this movie is better than the modern messaging, because it's more independent. It's not driven by blue or red.
Right. And she's like the originator of like why color happens in Pleasantville. And because, like, I think early on, like, she, Paul Walker, her, his character, he's like the prom king, like star football, captain of the football team. And he wants to go on a date with Reese's character. And like, that's actually going to throw a wrench into like the story of Pleasantville, because he's not supposed to go on a date with her. He's supposed to go on a date with someone else. And she like, no, I'm going to go on a date with him because I think he's hot and I'm going to go basically have sex with him in a car.
And then Don Knotts like gets on a little conference call with Tobey Maguire. And he's like, you know, Whitey Miller took so-and-so to prom. He's supposed to take Susie Q or whatever. And he's like, he can't do that. He can't take so-and-so to prom. Can you imagine watching a show that you've grown up and you know every episode and you're watching it? Imagine watching the Lucy show where she shoves the chocolates in her mouth. But in that show, she just does it all right. She doesn't have to eat any. Like, you're watching your favorite shows that you know intrinsically in front of you, but the stories are changing. Mm. Can you imagine that?
No.
And I'm asking for a very specific reason. Think about it. Can you imagine that at all?
I could. No. I could, but it's like an alternate reality type of thing, right?
Okay. Great answer, because that's exactly what's coming with some of the AI Sora video generation. You're going to be able to like put in prompts like show me an I Love Lucy episode like it was directed from Tim Burton. Show me an I Love Lucy episode where her and Ethel get in some new crazy scheme that they haven't done. Like, you're going to be able to do shit like that at some point. And it's going to blow your mind. You're going to be able to like do the episode where Lucy gets AIDS if you want, or like whatever the fuck. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to be able to like Sora and the AI. Now, I guess I don't really know how they're going to handle protected properties.
Yeah.
Like, but in general, you're going to be able to make people do whatever you want.
Yeah, no, it's very true. Like, it's definitely happening, like with a lot of AI things. Like, I know like the Wes Anderson style of making fake trailers with like about like Star Wars, but Wes Anderson is like started happening. But yeah, I mean, I don't know, like that is very interesting. I think it would be in practice it sounds genius, but it also is scary for like IPs.
It has the opportunity to be limitless entertainment,
mm-hmm.
if harnessed correctly, which is something at your disposal, not that somebody else has to produce for you, that AI will make almost instantaneously for you. That is fucking nuts.
Yeah, that is nuts. But yeah, Reese's, I mean, I will say, like, she goes on to have an amazing career, and I think this character is great. Like, I mean, the one scene with her that really sticks out to me, and we'll talk about the parents now as well, are played by William H. Macy and Joan Allen. They're the parents of Toby and Reese, but like, really, they're getting parented by Toby and Reese in this version, because they're learning from their kids of like how to be not repressed. Joan Allen's character is very sexually repressed. She's just like the housewife who serves on her husband, her kids, is very like selfless, and it come find out like that she's never had an orgasm. And that's so many women that's like that live in like that type of world, like who've never had an orgasm. And so what Reese does is she teaches her mom how to have an orgasm in the bathroom. And that was like Brennan, like, oh my God, that was bizarre. I started the movie on earlier this week with my kids, my 8-year-old twins. What? And I was like, oh shit, I'm glad they fell asleep because they should not be watching this.
Yeah. First of all, William H. Macy and Joan Allen are just great in this movie. They are so good imitating like 50s parents, don't you think?
Oh, totally. They're spot on.
William H. Macy, like, this is such a perfect role for him because he kind of has that little goofy, friendly dad thing going on anyway.
All shucks kind of personality. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so I tease this question. Brennan, who do you think is the protagonist and who do you think is the antagonist in this movie?
Like, of those two people?
Oh, no, just in general.
Well, I think the antagonist is, like, the mayor, right? Like, he's the one who's trying to oppress, like, all the people because he wants to live in his perfect little world. And the protagonist, I would say, is Reese. But, like, but then it becomes more than that. It becomes, the protagonist becomes people that are liberated and are seeing color and, like, know that there's something better out there, right?
Well, that's why I think it's a good question, because I think there's arguments to be made on a few different fronts, and I don't know for certain the perfect answer. I guess we'd have to have Gary Ross, the writer-director, on here to tell me. But I think that the way I look at it is change is almost the protagonist. Mm. And if change is the protagonist, that means that the status quo or keeping things the same is almost the antagonist. Like fear or the fear of change is the antagonist, is a better way to describe it.
Yeah.
Change to me is protag-antag, which is, I don't know. I've been fixated on this particular issue for a long time because I often think about stories slightly differently as a writer, and as a writer, you need to know who your protagonists, your antagonists are typically, and you need to like have them come out in different ways. And J.T. Walsh is definitely an expression of the antagonism. Mm. I think he's more of a manifestation of the antagonism than the actual antagonist. Like, I don't think that he doesn't have a lot of clear motives where he wants to oppress everyone and keep them down. He's just especially afraid of change. Mm. J.T. is how I.
Yeah, I mean, at one point, I feel like Don Knotts' character, he is very much the antagonist, too, because he definitely doesn't want this world to change, because he also, like, kind of gave, you know, Tobey Maguire and Reese Witherspoon access to make these changes, and he realized he fucked up. So.
Yeah, that's another manifestation of fear of change, right?
Mm-hmm.
Don Knotts doesn't want his favorite show to change.
Yeah.
And you could look at society a little like that. Like, you could look at like really old Republicans not wanting abortions, whatever, as a fear of change, because the show they grew up watching, you weren't allowed to get abort, you know. And you could kind of lens that through any political spectrum. Mm. Honestly, like, if this is the way it's always been, and that's the show I like watching, that's the way I want it to be, and I don't want change, you know.
Yeah, that's so true. Oh man,
Which is why this is a great movie and why I wanted to do it, because it invokes more thought and more feeling than most movies.
Right. No, it totally does. It definitely should be explored more, because in this point of time, like, there are people that live in America that they want to live in their world of Pleasantville. They don't want to have different religions. They don't want to have, you know, poor people. They don't want to have drugs or, you know, all this stuff. Like, they want to live in their version of Pleasantville, and like, that just, that can't exist in the world, in any, like, it needs to, people need to embrace that there are different like, ideas out there. And
California, they want to make Pleasantville never have existed, like, you know. We only want drugs and not and sex and whatever. Like, it's such a dichotomy, right? And what I said this earlier, but what I love about this movie is there's no right or wrong. It's like, it's finding your personal balance of change and tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So one of our new segments is called The Most Nostalgic Scenes. And Brennan talked about this one, but I think the first really scene that you remember is the scene where they get zapped into Pleasantville. Like, Tobey Maguire and Reese Witherspoon suddenly are in black and white, and they're suddenly dressed like it's 1950s, and their hair is all funny, and the parents are making them this really nice breakfast, which is weird because it was nighttime just a moment ago, and now they're at breakfast, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the parents are like Ward and June Cleaver, you know, to use a cliche. The breakfast is like amazing. It, like, all those old like mom TV breakfasts, it always looks like they've been cooking for like an hour and a half. You know what I mean? Like, you got up at like 5 and started this amazing breakfast that is fit for like a buffet. And people seriously have like a little bit of one bite of something, and they go out the door, right?
Totally.
They like drink some more juice, and they leave like this giant, like, tall stack of pancakes. Like after your mom did all that work, that would not fly in my house. My mom would be like, "You're gonna eat that shit."
Right. There, yeah. There's. I mean, it's obviously exaggerated, like, very, very much. Like, there. Yeah, I think that's the point. Like, laying the scene of Pleasantville and like them getting transported there, like, is very. It's very fun, because like, they can't miss, like, they're at basketball practice and like, no one can miss a basketball shot. And I don't remember what happens, but Tobey Maguire says something and like someone misses a shot and everything kind of like stops. But
he says something out that's not in a 1950s TV script. He says something with more ambiguity, you know? And everyone's like, "What?" And then like, suddenly their world doesn't work quite right.
Well, another one of my favorite scenes, we can talk about this very, very quickly, is I was rewatching it And one of the scenes that really struck me was when Jeff Daniels' character, like, Tobey Maguire brings him an art book and, like, kind of shows him all this art. Because he's, like, he wants to be an artist, but he... Because one of his favorite things to do is to draw the mural, the Christmas mural every year. And every year it's different. And that's a one thing he looks forward to every year. And he's like, why can't I do that all the time? And Tobey Maguire brings him this art book of all this, like, famous art. And the whole scene, like, you can just... Jeff Daniels does such a great job of just being that character and just, like, experiencing... seeing art for the first time, and it mesmerized me. I was just like, that's it was, he does a great job in this movie. But
yeah,
another great scene is when William H. Macy's character comes home and nobody's there, and we got a little clip from that.
I came home like I always do, and I went in the front door, and I took off my coat, and I put down my briefcase. And I said, honey, I'm home. Only there was no one there. No wife. No lights. No dinner.
No dinner?
I went to the oven, you know. I thought maybe she had made me one of those TV dinners.
Yeah, sure.
She hadn't. She was gone. I looked and looked and looked. She was gone.
It's going to be fine, George. You're with us now.
So this is all the dads, like, commiserating together at the bowling alley, like, on their, like, Tuesday night bowling league. All the dads are, like, huddled up talking about these crazy changes happening in their household. Like, they come home and their slippers aren't ready. You know what I mean? And they are just completely befuddled. Like, what the fuck is going on? They're not mad. They're just like, I have no idea why this is happening. My whole world is gone. All I know is... everything I've used to, like, have isn't there anymore.
Yeah, because I think all of them are kind of dealing with this on a level. Like, I don't know if, like, the mayor's, I don't know his family. I don't remember, but they're all kind of like, now the bowling alley is like this place of repression where all the, like, angry men go. And I think right after the scene is when they, like, basically get their pitchforks and torches and, like, they decide that they're going to stop everything from happening, which doesn't end up happening, right? I feel like it's one of these things, like, I watch this and I'm like, I understand it and realize how eye-opening this is, because if you have a mom that is, like, a stay-at-home mom and, like, serves on hand and foot for their husband, you've seen this before. And, like, I never really had that, but, like, there's a big group of people out there that have this every day and, like, realize that they think that their mom is just there for them to, like, or wife is there for them to, like, to serve them. And I'm like, that is messed up. And I think it happens to so many people in America. This, like, white picket fence and being stuck and wanting to, like, be someone you're not. And that's what all these people are learning, is that they can be more. And that's what Joan Allen realizes, that she can have. Joan Allen's character is very complicated in this, I feel like.
Realize that she can have lusty affairs with the soda jerk whenever she needs to help herself feel more complete.
But I don't think it's that simple.
No, it's not simple.
What else you got to say about that scene? Anything?
Well, I just want to make it clear that if you're a woman who wants to be at home and serve the kids and make a home and make a family and all that, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, there's plenty of women that's the route they go, and that's what they want, that's what they love. And there's women like that in my life that are amazing. And there's women completely the other way too. They don't want kids and they want careers and they want to have sex. And, like, and there's women like that in my life too, and that's okay. And that's what this movie's about, is it's okay if it's for you.
Right. No, that's totally true. I think the point I'm trying to make is that there are groups of people who live a life that they don't want to live, and then they realize, but then they realize it 30 years later, and then there's a lot of trauma that comes with that.
Sure, yeah. That's very sad. It is. And I think our culture, for all of its cons, that's one of the things that we've done right, is, like, we've allowed choice pretty well in this country, in my opinion, is that most people have a lot of free will.
Yeah.
So the last scene I want to bring up is a scene Brennan has referenced a few times. It's called Color in the Courtroom Climax. It's essentially J.T. Walsh and the other, like, black and white dads are sort of demanding that all these changes stop. that like it's going to be a crime if you paint out color outside the lines. And Tobey Maguire and Jeff Daniels are there kind of in defense of this, or excuse me, on trial of this, as sort of the agents of change. And during the trial, Tobey Maguire convinces everybody that change doesn't have to be bad, and he proceeds to change his dad's perspective, William H. Macy, in front of everyone in the middle of the courtroom, which turns William H. Macy from a black and white character to a fully colored character once he realizes that his wife, who's now different, is still beautiful and unique and he can still love her. So like, even though she's changed, he can still love her. Like, he's big enough, and then he changes too. And that's when everyone realizes, at least in the context of the movie, that's when everyone realizes that change can be okay if it's what you want. I think, anyway, I think that's my interpretation.
Totally.
Do you have one?
Let's play the clip.
You don't have a right to do this. I mean, I know you want it to stay pleasant around here, but there are so many things that are so much better, like silly or sexy or dangerous or brief. And every one of those things is in you all the time if you just have the guts to look for them.
That's enough.
I thought I was allowed to defend myself.
You're not allowed to lie.
I'm not lying. You see those faces up there? They're no different than you are. They just happen to see something inside themselves.
I said that.
I agree with you. I think it is like we all, I think it's mostly just about the ability to have choice of who we are as people and what we want to do with our lives. And I think the color of the people represents that. Like, they realize there is more to myself than having to be perfect or pleasant all the time. I want to do all those things that, you know, Tobey Maguire was saying. Basically, there's obviously the group of people that want to repress that. But in the end, they realize, like, no, we should all allow this to exist.
Obviously, there was a lot of downside to that, right? There was a lot of downside to the 1950s culture and lack of freedoms and privileges. But I guess I'm, if you can live in a world that's as equitable as 2024, but is limited in scope like the 1950s, I believe that could be better for our mental health.
I mean, I don't disagree. I think we're getting there though. I think we're definitely like, there's a lot of, I think millennials and like Gen X are like, they're the ones that are, have the mental issues and like feel like have the repression and like are coming out of that. I think the kids that are growing up now are realizing that they want to buck the changes to be happy, to have, live a different life because they want, they see what their parents lives like working a 9-to-5, and they want more and they want to be happier and they embrace change easier. Like for example, like when I was in high school, like it was not cool to like certain things. I had to be in a certain box, but like now, like there's people, like kids that like, they love playing basketball, being a jock, but they also then love like video games and like other things that like weren't cool to like they like so many different things, and they're acceptive of like people who like different things. I think the world is changing to a more accepting place, kind of like Pleasantville. But there's a bunch of people who want to just repress people still.
I hope you're right, but I would argue that like depression in kids and teenagers is like, it's on a sharp incline. It since like 2011, it's like more than doubled in like girls between like 11 and 15, something like that. Almost doubled for boys. Like it's like it, anxiety and depression are through the roof. So when you're a child, you can bounce back from these things. I remember thinking the biggest difference from like me in my 30s versus me before that was like my inability to bounce back from shit, you know, like shit would really start to weigh on me and affect me. And all I'm saying is these kids might believe the right things, but the toll that our society is taking on their mental health, will that leave them strong enough to implement the change? Like, or will it leave them like a lot of us where you want change, but like the world just beats you the fuck down?
That's an unanswerable question. I feel like we I hope that we're going in a world that living in a world that can embrace that type of change and get better. But I think the access to a lot of like people talking about mental health more has helped that a lot. But yeah, I think I don't think there's a great way. I think it would be great if we could all live in a Pleasantville, but it's just not.
Well, there is a Pleasanton near me in California. Could live there. It's quite expensive, I might add.
Yeah,
that's a nice place. But let's segue into the production
history. Yeah, for sure.
So the movie is written and directed by Gary Ross. He wrote the movie Big. Really, he wrote a lot of movies, actually. But I'm going to focus on he wrote Big. He wrote the first Hunger Games. I think he might have wrote the second Hunger Games. He wrote Seabiscuit. He wrote the movie Dave, that president lookalike movie. And he wrote the movie Mr. Baseball with Tom Selleck. I'm sure Brennan saw that when he was a kid.
Yeah.
He also directed Seabiscuit and Hunger Games. Like, this dude's got a really impressive resume.
Mm. Yeah, I've never really heard about him until I was, like, going through his filmography. And, yeah, he's done a lot of good things. I think he probably just picks and chooses what he does because he hasn't done a ton.
He does movies that audiences like.
Mm.
Like, maybe they're not always, like, super critically acclaimed, but even the one – but he has those too, like Seabiscuit. But even the ones that aren't critically acclaimed, audiences like them. They're, like, movies that you like to sit down and watch, like Pleasantville, like Big, like Dave. Like, they're, like – calling them feel-good movies is almost, a criticism to me because it makes it sound shallow, and they're not. Like, Big is not shallow. Like, Pleasantville's not shallow, you know? But there is a – I can identify with this person on a human level element to his movies that people like, I think.
Yeah. I will say his movies are very idyllic, if they say it right. But, like, Hunger Games is different. I mean, that was a book before he ever adapted. But, I mean, I agree, though. I love watching Hunger Games. It's a fun movie to watch.
Well, he's a good writer. That's really what I'm getting at. He's not a bad. The movie was produced by a lot of people, including Steven Soderbergh, which I thought was interesting because he's so thoughtful, you know, and his shit just hits you a little different. So I thought seeing him as the producer's list on this movie made sense. I was like, okay, I could see that. Steven Soderbergh had done Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and then he went on to do Aaron Brockovich and Ocean's 11, amongst a million other things.
Mm.
Dumb shit.
I don't know. I don't have a lot of dumb shit. I like this movie. I think it's really clever. I think it's like I said, it gets you thinking about a lot of things that most shit doesn't. I just want to discuss real quick the preemptive nature of the movie's message, more or less predicting the vast social changes the country would grow to adopt or embrace. Brennan said it earlier, it's sort of ahead of its time, you know? And it's non-politicized, which is what I think still works about it and why it endures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't have much dumb shit. I mean, I always go back to my dumb shit for this being casting in terms of, like, I still think, like, this movie is very, 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 very white. Like, if this movie was made today, there would be a lot more, you know, people of color in the movie. And I think this movie probably deserves to have more of that in it just because I think I think there needs to be more representation. I understand why back in the, you know, 90s, why there wasn't a ton of people of color in it, just because, like, that's how movies were cast back then.
Also, it's especially how they cast, like, those 1950s sitcoms.
Right, yeah.
So if you're gonna try and do any sort of realistic homage to those, pretty much have to have all white people.
I guess, but, like, I think there's examples of, like, stuff that happens today, like, shows that happen today, like Bridgerton. Like, I don't love Bridgerton, like, but it's critically acclaimed, and it takes place in, you know, 1600s or 1700s, like England or wherever they're at. And that's a cast of a wide variety of people of color, and like, it works. So like it could work if you cast people, of people of color in this movie. Like, you don't
I get what you're saying, but then there's the realist cynics like me that if you were, they would say that, like, if you were going to make an Andy Griffith or a Leave It to Beaver thing, and it was full of, like, all the colors of the rainbow, like, it looked like downtown San Francisco, there would be white guys that it would take them out of the moment. And, like, they're not even haters exactly. They're just, at least some of them, some of them are just pointing out, like, hey, this isn't accurate. And it takes you out of the moment because then it feels like political box checking.
That's fair. I mean, I agree with you there. I just think this type of movie doesn't need that. Like, I think you could, the message of the movie could exist with, you know, it could embrace that change for a modern audience.
If you're an audience that embraces change and you want to give us those sick 5-star reviews on Apple iTunes Music, we'd really appreciate it. Super90sbrothers@gmail.com is all spelled out. You can email Brennan directly. You can send him pictures of you and your kids doing stuff. More importantly, you can request topics of the show that we could cover or at least point out on future episodes, because we've only done, we're about 100 episodes and there was about a billion things that happened in the 90s that we can talk about. So add us at Super90sbrothers, at SpokeCastPods, AdamPitzler.com. Do you have anything else to say?
I got to say, I love this conversation. I know, like, there's parts of it that are like, man, you guys are getting really deep. But, like, I think this is what movies should do. Conversation should come from them, and people should push each other on ideas. And not everything needs to be, you know, so pleasant. And I think movies like this need to exist. So
how do they need to be so black and white either?
Exactly.
There's lots of room for discourse in this movie.
Absolutely.
It was a fun conversation. Thanks, Brennan.
Yeah.
So for Brennan Pointer, I'm Adam J. Pitzler. This has been another sock hop of an episode on Super 90s Bros, Pleasantville style. And remember, the next time your mom is feeling down or out of place, just politely encourage her to go have a lusty affair with the local soda jerk. Problem solved.
Peace.